Hi, welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to episode 100. This week's episode of Physicians Weekly's podcast is celebratory to honor our 100th episode. This has been a fantastic adventure, and we've been honored to interview more than 150 health practitioners to date, and we've been exposed to so much fantastic clinical science and expertise. We definitely need to thank all our guests, as well as all our regular contributors like Dr. Medlaw and Dr. Alex McDonald. This is also an opportunity to thank our sound guys at the audio, especially Danny Prent, he's been great, and the great staff at Physicians Weekly. But we would like to especially thank you, our listeners. To celebrate this milestone, Dr. Alex McDonald, Physicians Weekly's editorial board member and family sports medicine physician at Southern California Kaiser Permanente Medical Group, and I generated a list of our quote-unquote heroes of medicine, which we discuss in this episode, and this list reflects our personal choices, but just scrapes the surface. There's also an evident North American or European bias, and we'd love to hear your suggestions for future lists. Who are your heroes? Enjoy listening. So thank you everyone for being here. Today is podcast episode 100, and I've asked Alex McDonald, he's a regular contributor to the Physicians Weekly podcast. I've asked him to join me on this one because today we are going to celebrate the heroes of medicine. And that is a broad topic. Should we start off? Do you have a personal hero, Alex? And maybe introduce yourself first.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me back. I guess I didn't make too much of a fool myself the first time. I would have brought balloons had I known it was the 100th podcast, but you know, maybe next time we'll send flowers or something. Anyway, thank you so much. I'm Alex McDonald. I practice family medicine and sports medicine here at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. I do a little bit of everything. I'm a faculty member for a residency program. I work in the hospital. I do minor surgeries in the outpatient world, and I am a big health policy person. I love thinking big picture about how we can improve our medical system as well, too. So that's a little bit about me. I can go on and on, but I don't want to bore your listeners.
Well, we've been charged with talking about the heroes of medicine, and that's not a small task. So let's start with you. Do you actually have a personal hero of medicine? Those are often people that make you think out of the box and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think if for me personally, there have been so many individual mentors along my journey to help teach me. Is that what you're referring to, my kind of personal heroes and mentors? Yeah. So I think one in particular, his name's Bob Salas. He is the past director of the American College of Sports Medicine. I met him actually in medical school, and he really nurtured me and inspired me to become a family medicine and sports medicine physician that I am today. So Aaron Rubin was my fellowship director during sports medicine fellowship, and those two have sort of an outsized influence in my practice of medicine and who I am today. So those would be my personal heroes, I think.
Those are big ones, and it's so important. I've been having this conversation with pretty much everyone I run into is like, who's your hero? And I've gotten so many responses, but the thing I've really found is people really reckon back to individuals who really taught them some basics of being a good physician, like how to diagnose someone, you know, communication, or people that really, you know, didn't necessarily publish a lot or didn't, you know, weren't the brilliant minds, but were just the good doctors that taught them so much about the craft. So I've really enjoyed having these stories. But number one on our list, let me just go back to Hippocrates is our first choice here. And you know, it's kind of a cheesy choice. I think I put that in the notes even. But, you know, hey, we all swear an oath to him. And, you know, he promoted the idea that gods are not responsible for illness. What do you have to say about that choice? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sort of father of modern medicine, the idea that observation and prognosis and clinical skills and characterizing diseases and the formulation of illness versus health, his sort of humoral theory, if you will. You know, the question is, you know, how much was that him versus other people as well? We don't really know. There are not great records from ancient Greece, surprisingly. There's so much which we have built modern medicine on, which has been attributed to him. And I'm sure there are lots of people that helped and supported him in his journey as well, too. So it's important to think not just about him, but maybe all those who worked with him as well, too, because there's likely it was likely a team effort, as medicine typically is.
Yeah, it was probably a woman, but anyway.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
No, I think it's evidence-based medicine at its best, and it just started early, and you're right. Obviously, the records aren't good, but I think that that's a theme throughout all of these 14 individuals that we've put on this list as being heroes. And that is something because, you know, we don't know the hundreds of people that helped them get there. A lot of people haven't received the credit that they deserve for this. But so I should point out that these are not chronological necessarily, although there's a trend towards chronology. So we're going to skip around a little bit. Please excuse my chaotic approach here. But the next one on our list is Edward Jenner. And I put down the date 1796 because I think this was the date that was credited as the first vaccine. And do you know how he did that? Do you remember the story there?
I think it had something to do with smallpox and I believe cowpox also, if I'm not mistaken. And that's where the term, the pustules of the cowpox is a Latin root of the word vaccine, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Yeah, vaca. Vaca is cow, and so vaccine is indeed a cow with an E on it. But anyway, it's true. He just crushed up the pustules or the scabs from the pox and injected them into some people and then found that they were resistant to it. So they had got a milder case and were resistant to smallpox.
Which was, not... I wonder if that was, he had an IRB for that. I'm curious what the potential downstream side effects could have been for that too. But clearly, the upside worked in this situation. I mean, that's pretty amazing to think, to have that vision, to forethink that, hey, if we take this and give it a little bit to somebody else, can we boost immunity, which, we didn't know anything about it at the time. And vaccines are obviously critical in our longevity in this day and age, and we didn't die from all these communicable diseases in our 20s and 30s as they did back then. Pretty amazing. As many of you know, I'm a huge vaccine advocate, especially more in this day and age. I have to make sure we understand the history to continue to promote and educate our patients and our fellow physicians and our health policy leaders as well, too, quite frankly. But I'll get off my soapbox now.
Yeah, and careful stepping down, but I completely agree with you, of course. And I thought that this did show just a moment of brilliance. He had acknowledged that people who had had it before didn't get it again. And he saw that people that had cowpox didn't get smallpox, and it was a much more controllable disease. And so, I give him all the credit where credit's due.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
Okay, you want to do the next one on the list? Have you got the list in front of you?
Sure, I do. So the next one here, jumping ahead a few hundred years, is Watson and Crick. The 1953 proposed the double helix structure of DNA molecule, which I think is really pretty phenomenal. I'll be honest, in my clinical day-to-day world, I don't think about the double helix of DNA much, but obviously a huge important discovery, which was a foundation for multiple other discoveries since, which have amazing implications for our health.
Well, I think about it every day because I work with hereditary disease largely. So this is something that's so critical, is you have to know if certain DNA mutations are in cis or in trans, and you have to think about those strands. And it's fascinating to think about how, they segregate around families and how there's sometimes very complex situations like mosaic inheritance. And, this just started off all the possibilities of thinking about the permutations. But of course, there was someone else that was really involved in that discovery and that crystallography. I think she was the one that is credited for at least having identified the original, if not understanding the impact. She did actually generate some of the materials that they used to do the interpretation, and that was Rosalind Franklin. She should have been up there winning the Nobel with them, but unfortunately that was not the case. She's pretty much well credited these days for being part of that team, and her role is essential. And I believe there's a great TED Talk actually by James Watson where it's called How I Discovered DNA. And it's a parody. He makes fun of himself the whole time. Yeah, I recommend it to everyone.
Wonderful. I have to go watch that. I have not seen that. So wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. I always like to say that medicine is a team sport. And I think this is a great example of that, even though some people get the credit more than others. But it's important we sort of, give her acknowledgement as well. So I completely agree with you on that one as well.
Yeah, times change. And I'm glad she's being recognized now.
Agreed.
Louis Pasteur, 1864. This was a big one. He finally proved some pretty major stuff.
Yeah. So who knew that larvae didn't just come out of nowhere on the meat that was left out on the counter? So just the idea of microorganisms and hygiene, and there's so many things we just sort of take for granted in this day and age, which are really attributed to his work in terms of hygiene control. And there's a whole department in a hospital, infection control. Who knew regarding his work and the molecular basis of illness and disease?
Yeah, and hygiene. So when I was looking at this list last night and thinking about how we're going to go about this podcast, it occurred to me that a lot of this is the same list of things that if I were to have to step into a time machine and go back 200 years, what would I want to know and take with me? And a lot of it is real basic microorganism control, because that's something that really did change medicine and allowed us a life expectancy that is what it is today. I know that for sure that I would be dead without microbiotics. So it's something that I appreciate greatly.
Yep. I think we all underappreciate this, particularly when we, you know, think we go to the grocery store and we, you know, have expiration dates on foods, and that plus the fact that, you know, a lot of these foods have been sort of have been pasteurized, right? Literally, there's a term named after him for this work as well.
Exactly. So that brings me to antibiotics, which is sort of the next step down this road we just referred to, discovered by Alexander Fleming. That was just after World War One, right? That was a huge part of the difference between World War I and World War II, I think.
Yeah, so his discovery of penicillin, absolutely foundational. I guess I should give a caveat here or disclosure that I'm allergic to penicillin. So I have never actually experienced the direct result of his discovery, but obviously the hundreds of antibiotics which have come since and prevention of illness and bacteria overgrowth is really pretty phenomenal. And to think how many lives have been saved with the advent of antibiotics and penicillin. A little non sequitur. I threw away a moldy piece of bread last weekend. It had a little thing of mold growing on it. And I was like, oh, look, there's some penicillin. And I used it as a moment to teach my children. And they're like, oh, that's gross. I'm like, no. This is really important. It looks gross, but this saved millions of lives probably.
Yeah, I'm sure. No doubt, millions of lives. So, but both my parents are allergic to penicillin, and they always told me, like religiously, all as kids, never take it. You probably have it too, and I never did get it. But my daughter did, and she's also allergic to it. So we didn't do the same kind of, you know, chanting no penicillin to her.
Well, we still like Alexander Fleming for all of his work.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. And, you know, there are so many antibiotics. And of course, now we're approaching a big crisis with antibiotic resistance as well. So
absolutely.
Something to be concerned about. And that will require new innovation that we may be able to put on a list in at episode 200. So next on this list is a Hungarian guy. I'm not sure if you've ever even heard of him, but he is quite famous in Europe. And when I started asking my colleagues, I had two or three people name this guy. So his name is Ignaz Semmelweis. In 1846, he was an obstetrician, and he's the one that figured out that if he washed his hands between the births, he could actually reduce by half the number of fevers that the new mothers caught. So he was ostracized for this. In fact, there's even sort of a verb, like to be Semmelweist. It's to be ostracized for coming up with an idea that may be correct. But no one believed him, and they were just so ashamed to think that they might be causing it. The problems in these women, they told him he was full of baloney. Anyway.
Well, and I think part of his credit went back to Louis Pasteur. And once we discovered this germ theory, it gave additional credence to his work as well, too. The just kind of mind-boggling to think that washing your hands wasn't something that we do every day between every single patient. It doesn't even compute to think that this was seen as an ostracized idea. And anytime people have sort of weird, crazy, off-the-wall ideas, I always try to listen to them, too, because what's common today or what's kind of central to the practice of medicine today was probably, you know, completely wacky and an outside idea, you know, decades or centuries ago. And I think this is a great example of that. So one important thing we should all have in medicine is even if we hear this new crazy idea, we should never just ostracize it. We should, you know, listen to it and acknowledge it. And as evidence and data starts to show, we need to start thinking more about it and adopt it if necessary as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank God we did, because it did turn the tide for medicine for sure. The concept of hand washing. This next one is one I added to the list because I think it's had a really big impact at so many levels. It's not exactly medical innovation in and of itself, but it's about how we implement our information and knowledge. And that's for Harold Varmus. He won the Nobel Prize, I don't know if you know that, for finding an oncogene. And yep. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Wnt signaling pathway, but he's the father of the Wnt signaling pathway that drives colorectal cancer. And also some, I think he originally got the Nobel Prize for breast cancer research. And then later he became the director mm-hmm. of the NIH, and he was the NIH director for a good long time, I think on the order of 16, 17 years. And he's now very active in global yeah. oncology concepts. But what he really did that placed his name on my list was he started the Public Library of Science, or PLOS, and he decided that what mm-hmm. we were doing with this closed access publishing for medical sciences was completely absurd given the public need for this knowledge. And I respect him yep. so deeply yep. for starting and founding that movement, because now I would say we're definitely moving towards an open access only publishing system in the last 20 years. I don't have a date assigned to this, but I believe it was around year 2000, maybe a bit earlier, maybe 98, 99, mm-hmm. but it was about 25 years ago. And, you know, I think that we're slowly but surely seeing the fruits of that, those efforts. And open access publishing is allowing patients to read the original research. It's allowing citizens and students access to that. You do not have to be associated with a university necessarily to have access to those journals. So I think that's good science.
Yeah, absolutely. And to my prior point about, you know, making sure that we're very inclusive in data and evidence, and that people, we try to connect those dots, because there's so many people doing amazing research all over the world. And if there's a way that they're able to connect and amplify each other's efforts and augment each other's efforts, everybody wins. But also having the access for everyone. A lot of this research is based on public funds. And I think it's really, really important that a lot of this knowledge, yes, we need to give credit, and, yeah, and people exactly. who do the work should get credit and reward for that. There should be some incentive. But at the same time, a lot of this information is funded, at least in this country, on public tax dollars. And it's important that we make sure it's everyone's information at the same time.
I agree entirely. This is public knowledge. Mm-hmm. The next one, so that was number 7. We're going on to number 8. Are you familiar with this guy, James Lind?
No, you know what? I didn't actually know about James Lind until I was doing a little bit of research for this discussion. So please.
Well, I mean, I've only been told this story by a Canadian urologist I know, and then I looked it up and I thought it's cool too. So this yep. guy, he was a naval officer in the British Navy, and he was the ship surgeon, in fact, in the Royal Navy. And apparently in May 1747, he had a wild hypothesis about scurvy being caused by lack of citrus fruit, mm-hmm. lack of vitamin C. He didn't know it was vitamin C at the time, of course. So he performed the first clinical trial that we know of, and he gave some of the sailors, I think it was 2 oranges and a lime, or some limes and oranges in any case, and some he didn't give. And then he yep. followed their outcomes with regard to scurvy and decided indeed that his hypothesis was correct, that citrus fruits do relieve that. And that's how the British Royal Navy became known as Limeys.
Yep. Yep. I guess just to not upset any of our nations, he was actually a Scottish physician. And so just,
cause thank you for that.
Only because I looked important. It up, cause I didn't know anything about it before. The other thing he did too, which he also proposed, that you could distill seawater to create fresh water, which I thought was really interesting as well. And then he also correct. Had a lot of, he did some other work regarding improving the cleanliness of sailors, I mean, clothing and bedding below decks with air ventilation, to remove, you know, sulfur and arsenic, as well, to keep a lot of the sailors healthy. Who knew being on a ship for, you know, weeks at a time, shoved below deck without any ventilation was bad for us. Who knew?
Yeah, I know. Fun fact, did you know that rats are the only mammal that can drink salt water?
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Their kidneys are. That's why they're such a scourge on ships, because they don't require fresh water.
You know, I learned something every time I talk to you, Rachel, I learn something new.
Usually
so
about
you.
Kidneys. It's something that I'm really into. I can tell you about sharks sometime too. But anyway, it's super cool. But James Lind Foundation, it's a foundation named after him. It's in the UK. I'm actually more familiar with that than I am with James Lind himself. But mm-hmm. there are a foundation that work very actively with professional societies to bring in patient perspectives and work on prioritization. They have a whole methodology involved. So very impressed with them. Okay. Mm-hmm. Number yep. 9 is someone who recently won the Nobel Prize. Do you know about Jennifer Doudna?
Yeah. So CRISPR gene editing. I was actually a medical student. Yes, I was a medical student when this came out. And I remember one of our professors kind of going on and on about CRISPR gene editing and how this will revolutionize medicine and how we treat illnesses. And I think the progress has probably been slower than we were predicting back in 2006. But still, especially in the world of oncology, I think has made more advancements in other areas.
Actually, I would argue that I think the most commonly applied is in the sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
It's being used. It's FDA approved. And it's also been FDA approved for blindness gene therapy as well. So certain types of retinitis pigmentosum can be treated and actually restore vision in patients who have already gone blind. So that's pretty remarkable just by adding a gene back or correcting a gene. But also it's in the laboratory. It's also really sped up a lot of other technologies, including vaccine development.
Yep, exactly.
So gene editing, it's just a way of going along the genome and making the changes using two elements. You use a Cas9 enzyme, which is really what she discovered, and also a guide RNA. So you basically take the piece of DNA you're trying to target, you make an RNA, which is now called a guide RNA. It brings the Cas that cuts the DNA. It takes it to the right place, and then it excises the DNA that you want to remove. And you can introduce all sorts of things. You can introduce healthy genes, but you can also introduce, you know, if you're doing experiments in a lab, you can introduce mutations from your patient and discover what they're doing to the patient in a dish. So it's not been fully realized yet. I think that we're going to hear a lot more about that, but it is entering the clinic now and it is changing the world. So I'm looking forward to seeing more about this.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I am as well too. There is definitely brings up some ethical questions as well, which I think is important. We continue to explore that. But again, an amazing discovery, which is built on the work of Watson, Crick, and Franklin from 1953 as well. I guess I should also note that Jennifer Doudna is a graduate of Pomona College, which is where I live, actually. And I do some work with the Pomona College athletic teams as well, too. So there's a little bit of a connection there. I can say I'm like one step degree of removal from Dr. Doudna. But, you know.
Good. Well, me too. Well, I was at Berkeley, and she's a professor there still. So she won the Nobel Prize there. She's got one of those, like, six parking spots at Berkeley.
Oh, fancy. So,
on the campus. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, speaking of Berkeley, I guess I'm going to do my own personal hero next.
Please.
So when I was at Berkeley, I was there for many different years, and I took breaks in between and moved to different countries and practiced in Japan, and then I came back. And I always worked for the same woman, Mary Claire King. Now, Mary Claire King is not a doctor. She's not a clinician. She's a PhD scientist, but actually she's a mathematician. So why am I listing her? Because she actually did the math that none of us else could do and figured out that certain types of genetics are simply statistically, you know, have to be genetic. And she focused on breast cancer, and she proved that breast cancer could be a genetic disease in a set of family. And I was in her lab on and off during those years doing very laborious thing. But one of the jobs I had, which was for me why I'm listing her as a hero, was she really opened my eyes to the power of what you could do as a scientist to make the world a better place. So she did pro bono work for the people that went missing during the dictatorship in Argentina in the 1970s. At the end of the 1970s, a lot of children or parents were killed or disappeared, and the children were placed in other families. And there's a bunch of grandmothers, las abuelas, that meet every week at a certain memorial in downtown Buenos Aires. I was just there last week, actually. And what Mary Claire did was, she said, send me samples of blood from these people. And she matched 114 children with their family using very, you know, this was in the late 80s. So it was still very new stuff. And I was the technician sitting there pouring the gels for these sequencing. And back then we had to do sequencing on these huge, I don't know, 2.5 feet tall gels. They were extremely laborious process. But yeah, that work was just phenomenal. And to me, the idea that you could use this for human rights, you know, opened my world and actually made me a career, you know, patient advocate that I am today, because I just see the room and the power that you have, that you can develop combining these resources and these skills. So I will always appreciate her. She's won many prizes, and she's quite well known in the world.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. No, that's just incredible. And the fact you got a chance to work with her, and I did some work on like 2-inch gels. I can't imagine doing it on 2-foot gels.
Oh my God, they were a real pain in the butt to make because one thing went wrong,
right.
One little bubble, you had to start over again, you know. So, but that's why I was cheap labor back then. So,
but clearly very very effective labor based on the amount of work she's produced, right.
Well, I can't claim all of that, but I did some of
well,
it.
Well, and to the point of medicine being a team sport, and you know a lot of these people you know we all stand on the shoulders of giants, but those giants had people supporting them as well too.
For sure. Well, I have always appreciated her letting me be part of that team. So these next three won the 2019 Nobel Prize. So this is number 11 on my list. And why is this important? So this is Peter Ratcliffe, Bill Kalin, and Greg Semenza. And I have to say this reflects a lot of my network because I've been asking everyone who their heroes have been. And these guys came up a lot. And the reason why they won the Nobel Prize was because they are insanely curious about how oxygen regulates cell metabolism. And it is, of course, essential to life to understand this, but it has also driven a $16 billion industry in oncology. And understanding this and how our blood vessels react to low oxygen levels, it's got, of course, for sports medicine, a lot of implications. We know
absolutely.
About altitude illness and stuff as a result of this. And so these guys came up not because of their fantastic intelligence, which of course they are, but basically because these guys are the kind of guys you have a beer with and they will ask you about everything. And they're just so innately curious that you'll be exhausted at the end. And it doesn't matter who you are or what level you are. They just really want to get to the bottom of everything. And I've had the pleasure of knowing all three of them, but especially Bill Kalin. He's at Harvard. Peter Ratcliffe's in the UK. And Greg Semenza is on the East Coast. I don't know where. But anyway, they are fantastic guys. So they are hereby put on our list by vote of force. I think I had 10 people name them. So
wow, that's great. I mean, I think this has implications for a lot of the work that I do every single day. When patients come in with sepsis, is it with endo-organ dysfunction or not? And a lot of that is due to the work that they have done, and that dictates care. And if patients are already showing cellular signs of hypoxemia, how that directly impacts the care, whether we admit them, whether we don't admit them, you know, when patients are here at clinic, makes a huge difference. So this work is foundational to what I do every day in clinical medicine and don't really even think about it sometimes. So thank you for bringing this to my attention as well and having me learn a little more about it. I hope everyone listening right now will go and read more about these three gentlemen. It's really pretty amazing.
They are, and they also contribute a lot to understanding erythropoietin, how it works, and how kidneys function in that role. So, you know, it was really, for me, a transformational understanding.
Yeah. See prior comment about your love of kidneys.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't stop anywhere. I can go all day on
kidneys. It turns out the kidneys are very important to sustain life. Who knew? Anyway, I digress.
Well,
so the next one on my list was actually Elizabeth Blackwell. She was a British-American physician, first female physician ever, basically. She graduated from medical school, I believe, in 1857. And she was originally going to be a school teacher, but then realized that wasn't really suitable for her. The story goes, she had a female friend who became ill and said she would have had better care from a female doctor. And that really inspired her to go to medical school with a lot of the prejudice against gender and sex historically in medicine. And so she did amazing work, definitely a woman well ahead of her time. And now here in the U.S., we celebrate February 3rd, her birthday, as Women's Physician Day. And I think that's something very critical. I have my wife is a female physician. I have a lot of female physician colleagues I work with. And I think that we need to make sure we continue to pay tribute and understand about a lot of the revolutionary work that she did, facing a lot of bias and criticism for what she did as well, too.
Her sister was also a doctor. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, actually, no.
Shortly followed behind her. I don't think it was the second female doctor, but, you know, in the top 20 or 30. So she was a strong family.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last one I want to give a shout out to personally is Paul Farmer.
Yeah, great choice.
He died just last year. So he was a medical anthropologist and physician. He, you know, is basically the godfather of global medicine. He worked at the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard, created or co-founded Partners in Health, which is an international nonprofit organization that really provided direct healthcare services and did a huge amount of research and advocacy for those who were sick and living in poverty around the globe. He's really done so much work, but I think especially his writing on health and human rights and the social inequalities regarding the distribution of outcome of infectious disease based on poverty or economic means. So just amazing work that he has done in really pushing this important work forward, not just globally, but here in the U.S. as well. We have significant disparities that still exist based on individuals' socioeconomic status. And it's important that we continue to think about that and how we can really think of healthcare. And personally, and hopefully I'm going to get on my soapbox again, I think healthcare is a human right. And in the U.S., we are a little behind the curve, quite frankly, when it comes to the rest of the world regarding how we provide healthcare to our population.
But certainly ahead of some countries who have very few resources.
True.
But I think that's a great place for the final slot. I think he's absolutely inspirational. And what we've seen on resource-poor settings and how those have been tackled. And he was so inspirational in sort of starting the next chapter on how we approach things. And yeah, but I hope his legacy lives on.
Yeah, I think it will. I will do my part to make sure his legacy lives on, but hopefully he's trained and inspired hundreds, if not thousands, of physicians to carry on his work.
Well, that's it for our list. And I just wanted to thank everyone for listening. And please let us know if you have heroes that you want to add to this list. And we'll probably, you know, if we can pick this up. Also, living heroes are welcome. We'd love to interview them and hear about their achievements, but also their advice. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
All right.
Alex, thanks for your contributions.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.